Will you use your imagination with me for a moment? I want you to imagine you're in the garden and someone comes running up to the path. Someone looks quite serious, quite dignified, but quite an important person. Someone's been driving the queen. The queen's in the Rolls, part around the corner. And they're on the way down to the great birthday celebration that's planned next weekend now in Windsor. Only they've broken down. It's no good having a birthday party if the birthday girl's not there, is it? So, would you mind awfully? Have you got a car? Could you give the Queen a lift? Okay, put her on the back of the trike. Whichever. Okay, I don't mind which car you use. Well, what an honour that would be. Which of us would say no to that? I mean, you know, I don't care how Republican you are, you know, in your politics, the offer to give the Queen a lift to her own birthday. Well, yes, of course, Your Majesty. Let me just move the children's car seats out to the back and a quick dust over the kind of cake crumbs or whatever it is that are always on the back seat under the car seats. But there you go, and you get in and you take the Queen. Now, as you drive through, if you've been around St. Breville's, you'll have seen the WI been knitting, haven't they? This lovely bunting and the kind of model of the Queen down there. As you drive through, you'll see all the evidence of the fact she's Queen and that she rules. She's Queen of the whole country. And you might have seen that there's been this campaign to kind of litter pick for the Queen's birthday. As you drive around, well, then the streets look nice. As you're chatting to Her Majesty in the back of the car about this. And of course, you haven't filled the car up because you weren't expecting to be driving to London. So you've got to stop off at the filling station. And you're there in Tesco's in Chepstow. And as you pay for the petrol, you're reminded of the Queen's sovereignty, aren't you? As you open your wallet, there's her face staring out at you on every banknote, on the back of every coin. As you get near, you see the bunting and the flags. As you get into London and you navigate through the traffic, and maybe you've got police outriders now easing your path through. And as you approach the palace, you see how clean everything is. The care and preparation that's obviously gone in. You're drawing nearer now, aren't you, to the kind of seat of things. And the crowds are there. And as you pull up to the palace, there's this big, stern-looking man. Guns and all sorts. Well, I'd like to come in. You can't come in. You can't come in here. And there's a voice then from the back, isn't there? It's all right. This one's with me. And the guard steps aside and the gates open and you drive into the palace. And there's everybody waiting for the arrival of the Queen, and you can imagine as she enters the pageantry, the trumpets, the rejoicing, all those wonderful things as you enter and see the arrival of the Queen in splendor. Well, that kind of imagery, and particularly that progression, if you like, we see it here as we go through this psalm. The psalm begins with a declaration. The earth is the Lord's and everything in it. There's a declaration. In a minute you're going to come to a problem. And then beyond that you'll see a response. But there's a declaration. The earth is the Lord's. Now, I think probably the view of maybe most of our neighbours, of most of society, is this. God is kind of a private matter. If you're daft enough to believe in God, if you want to spend your Sunday evening that way, that's lovely for you, fine, you're welcome to do so. But frankly, that ought to be a private matter. Keep it to yourself. And as Christians, I think we're often tempted to think that God, well, he rules, maybe our life as individuals, as Christians, those who recognize him as king, great. He rules over the church, we would say that. But we sometimes tend to think that the rest of the earth, the rest of the world is somehow outside his control. There's God's bit, and then there's the rest. But by contrast, look at verse 1. The earth is the Lord's, and everything in it. The world, and all who live in it. Here's the declaration that's being made. There's a Dutch theologian who was their prime minister, in fact, a man called Abraham Kuyper, and he says something, I left the printout of this quote on my desk, so I'm going to do it from memory, and it's something like this. He says, there's not one square inch in all the universe over which Christ, who is sovereign, does not cry, mine. There's not one square inch in all the universe over which Christ, who is sovereign, does not cry, mine. Every little bit of it, mine, says Christ. Now, if every little bit of it, every square inch, well, that covers, I don't know, bits of Alpha Centauri, and these strange, the Horsehead Nebula, and little bits on icy planets like Pluto. Yes, every square inch of those, but surely if it's every square inch, it also encompasses, well, some rebels. Encompasses the little bit that I live and go around in. That bit must belong to him too. Why is it his? Well, verse 2 tells us it's he who founded it. He who's laid the foundation. Everything else is based on what God has done. Everything else is derived from it. All our human wisdom and skill and all the things we can invent and create. And humans are amazing with the things they can do. But all those things are based on the fact that it's God who has founded everything and laid the foundations. Now, what are some implications of that? Well, if the earth is the Lord's, if it belongs to him, if he is the owner of it, because he's the creator of it, then we're tenants of it, stewards of it. In other words, we are looking after something that isn't ours. And all the things you think you have, I said to you, well, what have you got? What do you own? What's yours? Well, all the things we have, actually, they're his. We're stewards of it. In other words, we look after them on his behalf. Now, what are some of the implications of that? Well, one is that it fosters in us a sense of contentment. What we have is from God. He's given us what he wills. And we pray, don't we, in the Lord's Prayer, give us this day our daily bread. The sense of dependence, of knowing what we need, and of contentment. If he is the one who is, it all belongs to him, and then he is free to do as he wishes. And we ought to be content with that. But the other thing it fosters in us is a sense of generosity. You see, what we have is not our own, it's his. And therefore we can use it generously on his behalf. And it also ought to foster in us a sense of confidence. You see, the earth is the Lord's and everything in it. He's founded it upon the seas. The sense of resting on him, of knowing that he is in control. He provides, he directs. Now, sometimes we find that difficult and we have to work through, well, in what way is God in control in this situation? Those are real questions. And sometimes they're hard questions we have to work through. Don't be afraid to work through those hard questions, but recognize this. It's God's, and therefore we can have confidence outside of God. Really, there is no security. There's nothing to hope in that lasts and endures. But here, there is something that we can hope in. Well, that's the declaration that begins. The earth is the Lord's and everything in it. It's his. And just as the Queen, as we drive through St. Breville's and down through the forest of the Severn Bridge, and we cross over and we go down the motor, we see signs of her reign. But now as we get nearer, we run into this problem. And here's the problem. The passage says that God has created everything, that he's founded it on the seas. He's established it on the waters. God is eternal and outside of everything and fixes these things. But you are not eternal. And you're not fixed and unshakable. Are you? No. You're temporary like I am. And here's the question, here's the problem we come to. Who is it that can ascend the hill of the Lord? Who may stand in his holy place? What hill is being spoken of here? Well, the hill of the Lord here, or his holy place, well, it's speaking about the temple. You know, Mark read for us, didn't he, from 2 Samuel, and he spoke of at the time David took the Ark of the Covenant, the Ark is the sign that God is present, up to Jerusalem, to the place where it was finally going to rest. And that's what's the hill that's being spoken of here. It seems that this psalm has been composed by David to be used on this occasion, to be sung on the occasion of taking the Ark up, okay? Right. Who can go up to the hill of the Lord? In other words, who can go into the presence of God? Who can be acceptable to God? Now, one of the things you get if you read the Bible, you get this pronounced view of the holiness of God, the seriousness of God. How serious a thing it is to come and stand before God. We didn't read it, but if you read the earlier part of 2 Samuel, you discover something about the holiness of God, how a man who comes with a casual attitude towards God, he's concerned about God, but perhaps not aware of God's holiness or God's standards, what God requires, ends up dying because of it. Well, you say, that's shocking. Yes, it is shocking. That's something we could, again, dig into, but I want us to see this. How on earth can we approach a God like that? How can you come close to a God who is this holy, this serious? How could you hope to stand, it says, who could stand in his holy place? How could you be with a God like that? What sort of person? What would you have to be like? Well, it asks the question, it answers the question, doesn't it? Who could do that? Well, verse 4, he who has clean hands and a pure heart, who doesn't lift up his soul to an idol or swear by what is false. Someone who has pure hands and a clean heart. Someone who on the outside in the things they do and on the inside in the things they think is pure. Now, you're all nice, respectable people. You are. And you know, you're likeable and your neighbours think well of you and you live in, well, in either in St. Breville's or in a kind of forest area. You're good, respectable people, fine. Your hands are clean, you might say to me. Yeah, okay, you do your best, yeah, like me. But hang on. He who has clean hands and a pure heart. Now, you might be outwardly respectable. Yes, you do good. Yes, I know you do. Your hands, yeah, they're clean. Honestly, a pure heart. Suppose with the advent of technology, I could take a lead from the computer there and plug it into your brain and project all your thoughts up onto this screen. Everything you've ever thought, I could scroll through the archive there. Pure heart. Honestly? You're telling me there's nothing that you think that you don't want put up there? Well, you're lying to me, aren't you? Because I know I don't want my thoughts put up there. Because I never know, however respectable I might seem and outwardly nice I am, my heart is a rotten mess, frankly. The one who does not lift up his soul to an idol, the one who doesn't worship falsely, or swear by what is false. Don't our words give us away? I mean, the Bible talks a lot about the way we use our tongue. It says in James, it's the thing that's hardest to control. talks about how destructive it can be, how it's like it can be like the rudder that steers a ship. It has big influence. You compare it to a match that would start a fire. You've seen on the news this wildfire burning in Alberta. What did it take to start that? Oh, just a spark. Just a cigarette butt thrown out or a match dropped, or that's all it took. And now look at it. Well, the Bible tells us the tongue is really powerful, but the tongue is a really good indicator of what's going on. And you know yourself, don't you? I know myself. How easily our words betray us. How quickly we can snap at people. How our short temper can show our view of ourselves and our view towards other people. How our tongue can, well, how we can use our tongue to gossip and to murder other people's reputation. How we use our tongue and we lie. I mean, we don't like outright lie, but we certainly don't necessarily tell the entire truth, do we? And we do that, why? Because we want to, well, we want people to think well of us. And so we, have you sent that letter? The letter that's on my desk that I need to drop in the, yes, of course I've done it. Well, it'll be in the letterbox now on the way home, won't it? Do you see what we do? We lie, don't we? We our tongue betrays us, and we do that because, why? Because we want people to think well of us. But a pure heart. Oh, we've been talking on in the last few mornings about that we tend to think about what's going on the outside, but Jesus, in dealing with people, is concerned about what's going on the inside, people's heart. Or you think of what Jesus says as he teaches in Matthew 5. He says, "Blessed are the pure in heart." How could I have a pure heart? Can you and I have a heart such that we would be happy for our inner being to be projected on the screen? The Bible tells us that we can be made clean. We can be washed. Washed, it sounds a bit gruesome, in the blood of Jesus. In other words, Jesus' blood shed on the cross, his death there, is the way in which we can be made clean. It's the way we can approach him. Who may ascend the hill of the Lord? Who can stand in his holy place? Who's fit to come? The person who's been washed clean. How is it that we can approach? Well, think back to the analogy, the picture of you as you drive the Queen up to the palace. How can you come in? Because she turns around and she says, "It's all right. They were me." That is what, as Christians, we come to. The work of Jesus is to turn and say, "This one's with me. They're okay. They can come." That is how we can stand in his holy place. That is how we can ascend the hill of the Lord. So we've seen the declaration, the earth is the Lord's. We've seen the problem. How can we approach? Who may ascend? We've seen, I suppose, the solution. In the reading that Mark gave us in 2 Samuel 6, as they came to approach, one of the things they did was they sacrificed animals. The sacrifice of animals points forwards to the death of Jesus on the cross. So there's a declaration, there's the problem, the problem's resolved. But now here's the response, and this is the last part, verse 7 to the end. "Lift up your heads, O you gates. Be lifted up, you ancient doors, that the King of glory may come in." Oh, what on earth is this talking about? I mean, whoever talks to furniture like this, you know, fittings and stuff. Lift up your heads, gates. Lift it up, doors. Well, of course, it's the gates through which the king, the queen, enters. It is their coming. And coming in glory. I want you to kind of picture, now, rather than our queen returning in the back of your clapped out Fiesta to go to her birthday party, I want you to imagine not an elderly lady, but I want you to imagine a mighty monarch returning in triumph from his victories. That is the imagery that's being used here. Who is the King of Glory? Well, the Lord strong and mighty, the Lord mighty in battle. Not that God is physically a king like this. Not that he's physically involved in battles, but it's showing his strength, his glory. And he's picturing the way that a monarch who's been out to fight in battles is returning in triumph and victory. And all the people have come out to celebrate. And by even the gates that he's coming back into, they've been thrown aside and they've been told to join in the celebration too. But what's it on about? It's all fascinating, but do you know what day Thursday was? It was Ascension Day. There you go. Ascension Day. Ascension Day when, as Christians, we remember the fact that Jesus, after his death and burial and resurrection, then spent another 40 days with his disciples. And at the end of that period, he goes into heaven. He ascends, hence Ascension Day. He returns back to heaven. And what is being pictured for us here is this. It's the approach of Jesus coming in triumph. As the Son of God, who has taken on flesh and has gone to earth and fulfilled this incredible mission that he has. As he comes back into the splendor of heaven, the gates of heaven being told, look up, lift up your heads. The doors being flung open. Why? So that the King of Glory can come in. We tend not to think much of Ascension. I think it's because it always falls on a Thursday and we can kind of forget about it a bit and we don't remember till Sunday and we come here. But hey, this is important. It is not just that Christ, the Son of God, came in flesh, was born as a baby. Yes. It's not just that he lived his life. Yes, he did. It's not the great miracles and teaching that he did. Marvelous so they are. It's not merely his death. It's not enough just his resurrection. But his ascension. His return to glory. In Ephesians chapter 4. It says this, when he, this is speaking about Christ, ascended on high, he led captives in his train and gave gifts to men. Now, what's being spoken of there? You know, the Roman generals, when they used to, if they'd come and, when Caesar came and conquered Britain, they go back to Rome and they march their army through the city in what's called a triumph. And the general gets processed and all the captives, all the kings he's defeated, get dragged along behind in chains as the evidence of his greatness. It's a pretty gory picture, I know, but there you go. But that's what's being spoken of here, that Christ in returning leads captivities captive. We were once in chains. We were once bound and beaten and defeated. And now we've been set free. We've been rescued. That's what his death on the cross does for us. He has conquered those who held us captive. And so he marches in triumph in this great procession as he comes in. He is the King of Glory. Who is the King of Glory? The Lord Almighty. He is the King of Glory. Now we started off looking at the whole universe and saying the whole universe is his. It all declares his glory. Yes, it does. Just like St. Breville's announces the reign of our Queen with knitted bunting and the thing down on the tongue. And just as when you pull out your wallet, it announces the reign of the Queen. But if you want to see the glory of the Queen, it's seen, yes, in a whole domain, but it's seen most of all when you come to the very heart of matters, isn't it? To where she is on the throne. Well, if you want to see the glory of God, you see it in creation. We often talk about the glory of God in creation. How wonderful it is. Well, rightly so it is. But if you really want to see it, if you want to see the good stuff, yeah, you see it in creation, but more than that, you see it in redemption. You see it in his work to bring us back, to free us from captivity, and to make us his. Well, may God give us eyes to see these things. Let's sing.